So we come to our second part of Daniel. This book, this scroll, was published between the year 170 and 164 BC. I wouldn't say I was absolutely certain of that, but I think that's probable, and that's pretty, there's a lot of basis for that statement. We saw last week what I mentioned to you, the stories that are gathered from the past that he's put together about this legendary Daniel at the time of the exile, and stories had grown up about them, which were all about encouraging people to Jews who, in Judah, who are very oppressed and very broken, and all the promises don't seem to have been fulfilled, trying to get them to keep their faith in Yahweh. Well, then the author, in Aramaic, in 170, writes an appendix to that, which is a very important chapter of the book of Daniel, which we'll see. Then after that, continuing from 167 to 164, not necessarily the same author, we have an updating during the period of the persecution of Antiochus Epiphanes IV. And so there's a series of those, and they're all in Hebrew. They're all written currently to be part of the Hebrew tradition. So Hebrew is their sacred language, so that gives it certain importance. And at the end, which we may come to, there's some material you only find in the Greek version, in the Septuagint, which is in Greek, and there are further stories about Daniel. And there are others found in the Aramaic Targums that aren't in the Bible, and so on. So it was a popular story. He was the popular character to tell stories about. Let's look at chapter 7. Chapter 7 begins with a dream that Daniel has. I won't read it all to you, but it's very like chapter 2, which talked about this statue with gold head, and you might remember the bronze body and the clay and the feet. This is a similar pattern, but it's now beasts, monstrous beasts coming out of the sea, that is chaos. So these are obviously chaotic forming creatures that are coming up. And there's a lion, and there's a bear, and there's a leopard, and there's a fourth beast with four heads. The leopard has four heads, and they're the Persian, etc. Then there's another beast with 10 horns, and we'll describe this in a minute. And then another extra horn sprouts out of the 10. And we know there were 10 Seleucid kings, and this is now Antiochus Epiphanes. Everyone reading it would know, but anyone who was persecuting people wouldn't know what they were reading. It's like in code. And once you, like the apocalypse, once you break the code, it all falls out pretty simply, unless you're a fundamentalist who's gone berserk and hasn't bothered with any code, takes it all literally. Now, in that, Antiochus is described there as, in his horn there were eyes like human eyes and a mouth speaking arrogantly. This is Antiochus Epiphanes. And then I'll read verse 9. As I watched, thrones were set in place. An ancient one took his throne. His clothing was white as snow. The hair of his head was like pure wool. His throne was fiery flames with wheels of blazing fire. Some of that imagery comes from Ezekiel, if you remember when we did Ezekiel with the chariot, etc. So this is God, clearly. This is El. This is the high God in the court. Like Olympus is the Greek thing, Greek equivalent. And there's all the other minor gods around, and then Yahweh, who is the high God, is there. A stream of fire issued and flowed out from his presence. 1,000,000 served him. All the angelic choirs, 10,000 times 10,000 stood attending him. The court sat in judgment, and the books were open. These are the books of judgment. So he's imagining, dreaming, visioning the last judgment. See, at the moment, the Jews are being persecuted, killed, wiped out. All dreadful things are happening in the temple, and so on and so on and so on. And they're in a state of complete disarray. And he's saying, let's look at how God sees the world and what the judgment of God is. So that's what we're going to watch. The books are open. Then, because of the noise of his arrogant words and that the horn was speaking, as I looked on, the beast, this is Antiochus, was slain. Consigned to the fire, that's Gehenna, hell, and consumed. So every Jew cheers, of course. This is great. The crook who's running the damn thing is God says, oh no. As for the rest of the beasts, they're the lion, bear, leopard, etc., their dominion has been taken away. They're no longer running anything, and their lives are prolonged for a little time. So there still are Persians around, there still are Babylonians around, and Medes, and so on, but this one has been slain, this final one. Then, as I watched in the night vision, I saw someone in human likeness. This is Aramaic, so if it was Hebrew, it would be Ben Adam, son of man. Ben, son, Adam, man, humankind, son of human, a human being, in other words. This is Bar Enosh, which is the equivalent in Aramaic of Ben Adam. So there's nothing special about that. Bar Enosh means I saw someone who, well, the best way to translate it is son of man is how you often find it translated, and that's fair enough. And that becomes significant for the New Testament use of Jesus for that term. But if you're going to translate Bar Enosh, you just say someone in human likeness. So looks human, this. Coming with the clouds of heaven. So it's not just whatever it is, it looks to be human, but it's actually coming where only God can come, on the clouds of heaven. So it's very much belonging to the divine sphere, this whoever it is. He came to the Ancient One, God, and was presented before him. And to him, not to the beast just been slain, Antiochus. No, it's to this one, with human likeness one, was given dominion, glory, and kingship. Every people, nation, and language must serve him. His dominion is to be everlasting, never passing away, his kingship never to be destroyed. Picking up terms that they used to use of the Davidic king, the messianic promise, and so on. So we're caught up in all that. Then, that's the vision. From verse 15 to 28 comes the interpretation. And in the interpretation, we're told by this angelic medium, God is still transcendent, so it's God communicating it, but as it's staged, it's an angelic presence, because you can't have God on stage, you know. So he tells them that the lion was Babylon, that the bear was the Medes, that the leopard was Persia, and there were four heads because there were four Persian kings known to the author. And I'll give you the name: Cyrus, Xerxes, Artaxerxes, and Darius. They're the four famous ones, and they're the ones our author knows. So that's the four heads. Then there's the fourth beast, which is the Alexander the Great, but the Seleucid part of it particularly, and we know there were 10 rulers of that up till this time, so they're the 10 horns, and Antiochus, I've explained already, but that's all explained in those verses. Verse 18, but then the holy ones of the Most High, and scholars are a little bit, well, it's not, we're dealing with interpretation of very symbolic writing, so you can't expect total clarity. Some suggest it's like the angel guardians, the heavenly equivalents of Judah. each country has its own god in the ancient polytheistic world. Well, in the Jewish world, where monotheism is at least leaking into the idea, rather than talk about them as gods, they're talking about them as angels, so an angel guardian for Judah. So these are the holy ones, the protective patron spiritual beings who in heaven look after us on earth. They will receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, forever and ever. That sounds good. So it's our... Okay. Then there's a bit more. Verse 24, the horn, this is Antiochus Epiphanes, will attempt, this is a quote, will attempt to change the sacred festivals and the Torah. It's exactly what he's trying to do. They will be given into his power, this is very important, for a year, 2 years, and half a year. 3.5, which is half 7. 7 is, you know what to be. So we're at the nadir, we're at the bottom of the... We're in the pits here. This, you can't get further away from good than 3.5, because from then on you're working your way back to 7, and you've worked your way... Okay, so this is a symbolic number for the time of persecution. Critically important, verse 27, the kingship and dominion and greatness of all the kingdoms under heaven will be given... Here it doesn't say the holy ones of the Most High, but the people of the holy ones of the Most High. Holy ones of the Most High are probably these angelic patrons. The people are us, the people of Judah. We will be the ones. Their kingly rule will last forever, and all dominions will serve and obey them. So in this massively important appendix to all these stories that we've been hearing about Daniel being getting to the top rank and the others with him lifted up, and ultimately the people being, and then the pagan gods, the pagan kings, I beg your pardon, of Persia, Babylon, talking about worshipping God and how good God is. When you've got all that background story, here he brings it out and he's telling us, imagine us as the people of the time, we're in the middle of a persecution, or the persecution is upon us, but in the judgment of God, God's judgment is in our favour. We, the kingdom of God, we hold. So don't measure success by whatever's going on in your life, and God is there protecting you. Just a minute then, I need to just come to, and I don't need to, but I'll come to the New Testament, and in there you've really got the key to why Jesus talks of himself as the Son of Man, the Ben Enosh, Bar Enosh from here. This is where it's coming from. The Son of Man, why does Jesus call himself the Son of Man? Now, it's a big question. There are libraries used to be written on it. Now I think there's a consensus that's pretty peaceful and simple, really. Jesus is the one who identifies with the poor and the broken and the persecuted and the outcast and the lepers and the okay, he's the one he's identifying with, and he's also bringing God's judgment. That's, judgment is important here, because we've got the books are open. So he's bringing God's judgment to the earth, the kingdom of God. He's telling him what the kingdom of God is. And it's about, I was hungry and you gave me to eat, I was thirsty and you gave me to drink, and all that you know. So in Jesus, instead of identifying with all these highfalutin titles that come from the Old Testament and were current in his own day, and the reason why he didn't identify with them is because no one understood them correctly. If Jesus said, I'm the Messiah, well, they know what the Messiah is, so they make him king and get rid of the Romans, and you know, or if he said, I'm this, or I, anything he said about himself in their terms would be totally misunderstood. So he uses this incomprehensible, in a way, dream-like term. So they have to think, what's he mean? What's he mean? And they have to watch him to find out what he means. Right, so that's that. Now we come to the reflections on the persecution from 167 the last 3.5 years or whatever, through to 164, and it's all in Hebrew. Now we're back to our sacred language. In the first one, that's chapter 8, which I won't read for you, read it for yourself if you wish to. It's all about a ram and a he-goat and a horn. So we're the similar type of things. And I'll read 8, 13 to 14. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to the one that spoke. These are the heavenly angels, if you want to call them angels. But for how long is this vision concerning the regular burnt offering, the transgression that makes desolate, and the giving over of the sanctuary and the host to be trampled? How long is the persecution going to go on for, is the question. Answer, 2,300 evenings and mornings. Then the sanctuary will be purified. Now I sat at my desk and worked out there are 2,300 evenings and mornings. Ends up being 1,150 days, because there's one in the morning. So 1,150 days is 50 days short of 3.5 years. Isn't it? So, yes. So whatever's happening is, but it appears, see, they could have just added up to 3.5 years, and you'll see that happening again. So I think the point is, It's moving. We've done 150 days of this persecution period, and we're on the way out, and it's getting shorter and shorter and shorter as we move through. In other words, they're shortening the time, but still in these extraordinary numbers.
Only 20 sleeps to go to Christmas.
That's it, that kind of thing. That's it. So then the interpretation is given. The ram with the two horns is the empires of the Medes and the Persians. The he-goat is the empire of Alexander the Great, and the horn, of course, is, as you all know, Antiochus Epiphanes the Fourth. I'll read to you a little bit from the book of Maccabees, which is the history, in a way. We're getting into a bit of history now, because we're into that period, of what actually happened during this time. And in that book of Maccabees, chapter 1, 41 to 50, I'll read it for you. This is the account of what was going on in that persecution period. The king wrote to his whole kingdom that all should be one people and that all should give up their particular customs. All the Gentiles accepted the command of the king. Many even from Israel gladly adopted his religion. They sacrificed to idols and they profaned the Sabbath. And the king sent letters by messengers to Jerusalem and the towns of Judah. He directed them to follow customs strange to their land, to forbid burnt offerings and sacrifices and drink offerings in the sanctuary, to profane Sabbaths and festivals, to defile the sanctuary and the priests, to build altars and sacred precincts and shrines for idols, to sacrifice swine and other unclean animals, and to leave their sons uncircumcised. So they're trying to break the culture. They were to make themselves abominable to by everything unclean and profane, so that they would forget the Torah and change all the ordinances. He added, whoever does not obey the command of the king will die. So that's the situation they're in, and we've just had another dream about... Then comes the second one. Chapter 9 to verses 1 to 27. And here is an attempt to interpret that famous saying of Jeremiah, which haunted them all the time. And you see it comes right through Zechariah earlier. He made this statement in his scroll, Jeremiah 29:10, I've got it there for you. Only when Babylon's 70 years are completed will I visit you. So God is saying this before the destruction of Jerusalem, you see, through Jeremiah. I will fulfill to you my promise and I'll bring you back to this place. Well, Zechariah, after the return from exile, read that as a 70, of course, is a rounded number and a bit sacred, and you can hear that, as the time from the destruction or the capture of Jerusalem in 598 till the return in 539, which is 70 years, 69 years, whatever. So that's how they interpret it. So in other words, we're fulfilling the promise given us by God has been faithful. We're going back to the promised land. But that didn't work too well. So Daniel, as described here, wants to find out what was Jeremiah saying. What was God saying when he said, I'll come back in 70 years and bring you home? So he fasts and he prays and he's preparing for enlightenment. And then the enlightenment comes. So 9 verse 17. Now therefore, O our God, listen to the prayer of your servant, to his supplication, and for your own sake, Lord, let your face shine upon your desolate sanctuary. Incline your ear, O my God, and hear. Open your eyes and look at our desolation in the city that bears your name. We do not present our supplication before you on the ground of our righteousness, but on the ground of your great mercy. O Lord, hear. O Lord, forgive. O Lord, listen and act. Do not delay. For your own sake, O my God, because your city and your people bear your name. And after that beautiful prayer comes the interpretation by the author of the 70 years. He talks about 70 weeks of years. So 70 weeks of years is 7 by 70, 490, is it? Whatever. So, and he divides it up into the... he's only actually interested in the last week, which is the one we're living in, right? First 7 weeks of years, that is the first 49 years. You with me? A week of years is... okay. That's from Jeremiah's prophecy to the return from exile of Zerubbabel, the anointed prince. Verse 25, that makes a bit of sense. It fits in with Zechariah's interpretation so many years before. Then comes the next 62 weeks of years, which is actually 434 years. And he measures that from the return from exile to the murder of Onias, the high priest, in 170. Actually, it was only 350 years, and he's made it 430, but it's all pretty, you know. Nobody did their homework as well as I did. That was their problem. So that's that. It's kind of vague, but here comes the real interest, is in the final week of years, the final 7 years, from 170 to the time of writing. The desecration of the temple in 167... which was called the abomination of desolation, and it's referred to in the eschatological discourses in the New Testament as well, and that's in verse, is halfway through the final 7 years, from 170 to 163, 64. So inclusive, so 164, that's the period of the writing of this book, this manuscript. So the persecution has reached its turning point, 3.5 years. So the prophecy of Jeremiah is on the verge of fulfilment. See what they're doing? They're trying to make sense of their literature in the light of their experience, which is what we're all asked to do. Chapter 10, right through to chapter 12, verse 13, is the final revelation given to Daniel, and that's probably written in late 165, so it's very near the end. The end was the death of Antiochus Epiphanes in 164 and then the success of the Maccabean revolt. They were the two things. So Daniel has this vision, and I'll read a little bit of it for you. I looked up and I saw a man clothed in linen. Linen is a giveaway. That's the priestly vestments. So apparently it was very costly stuff and not everybody dressed in linen. Other people may have, but that was typical of a priestly gown. So I looked up and I saw a man clothed in linen with a belt of gold of Ophir around his waist. His body was like beryl, his face like lightning, his eyes like flaming torches, his arms and legs like the gleam of burnished bronze, and the sound of his words like the roar of a multitude. Has anyone got a Bible in their hands that I can easily get hold of? I forgot to bring mine. God bless you. Can you translate from sight? The book of the Apocalypse. God, isn't she a darling? The book of the Apocalypse, if you'd go to that at the end, it's chapter 1. Book of the Apocalypse. Beginning of that book.
Sorry.
Well, let me do that so you won't tread on it. It'll be right at the end, the last book in your Bible. That's the Old Testament, New Testament.
John 14, 13.
Okay, now.
Here.
Oh, there. Now, where does it say he saw this vision of the Son of Man? It's in chapter 1.
Yeah.
So it's pretty...
How big is chapter 1?
Not too big. Somewhere there you'll say someone like the Son of Man.
About the Son of Man.
Yep.
Yeah, I haven't
got it. Or about this figure that Jesus Christ, it describes him, the risen Christ. And his face like the shining of the sun, anything like that?
Island Patmos.
I'm looking here. Is this
a voice coming?
Hey, what's that say?
He saw the seven golden candelabras, candlesticks. Ah. Yeah.
Okay.
And when I turned about, you want to hear this?
Yes, we want to hear it.
And I turned about so that I could see the voice that spoke with me. And when I turned about, I saw the seven golden candlesticks, and in the midst of the candlesticks, somebody like a son of man, dressed with a garment and as low down as to his feet. And at the chest, there was a golden girdle. And his head and his hair were white as white wool, like snow. And his eyes as a flame of fire. And his feet were like burnished copper, as in an oven, made fiery, made hot, and his voice was as a sound of many waters. And he had seven stars in his right hand, and out of his mouth came a double cutting sharp sword, and his face was like the sun shines in all her power.
That's beautiful. That was the translation from Dutch straight into English, because I forgot to bring my Bible. But did you get the message? That's a description of Jesus, the risen Christ. And, you know, people sometimes ask, what's the risen body like? Well, that's the best picture you're going to get of the risen body. Like, you cannot describe the risen body except in terms like roaring of waters, and it's all symbolic. It's the person is taken into the mystery of God as the person is, but totally transformed. Eye has not seen, ear has not heard, nor has it entered into the human heart what God has prepared for those who love him. we can't but imagine the risen body to be like this, because that's how our imagination's hardwired. It's the only body we know. But when in faith, you have to put a line through your imagination and just say, haven't got the faintest idea, but it's going to be wonderful. So that's here you've got this vision again, the apocalypse writer drawing on this Daniel image. The prince, this is chapter 10, verse 13, the prince of the kingdom of Persia opposed me for 21 days until Michael, here we are, one of the chief princes, came to help me, and I left him there with the prince of the kingdom of Persia. So this is the angel guardian of all the spirit of Persia, and there's Michael and this other prince, and have come to help you understand what is to happen to your people at the end of days, for there is a further vision for those days. Then the heavenly apparition continues, and it goes on the text, chapter verse 20 of chapter 10, I must return and fight against the prince of Persia. What happens in heaven is real. And it tells us what's going to happen on earth. The real world is the heavenly world, you see. That's why you've got this fight of the angels. And when Michael defeats Satan, that means the good, the church, is going to defeat evil. Didn't get me? That's the real world. And a seer sees into the real world where everything's really organized and happening. And then, I'm not saying this from me, but I mean, this is the way they looked at it. That'll tell you what's going to play out down here. There's one with me who contends against these except there is no one with me contending against all these other gods except Michael, who is the patron angel, patron heavenly being of the Israel, the people of God. Of course, that's taken over by the church too. In chapter 11 through to 12:4, I won't read any of that, but you can read it for yourself if you want to. It's actually a hidden or in cryptic story of the history of the kings and the interspersing of love between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. It's actually quite a, because they knew their history, recent history. So it's put there and you can read it for yourself. The author is offering a survey of history from the end of the Babylonian exile up to his own time. His focus is on the kingdoms that have had a direct influence on Judah. He presents it as a revelation given nearly four centuries earlier to Daniel. In other words, Daniel saw all that's happened in our... He's looking back, of course, the author. But he's saying Daniel foresaw it all before it happens. Meaning, it's all in God's hands. God knows what's happening. God's in control of the world. God's in his heaven, all right with the world. Have you heard that before? Till you have a look at the world, and then you think, well, who said that? So it's that's what they're doing. They're projecting it. He presents this, as with earlier sections of the book, he does so to remind his contemporaries that their God is the Lord of history, who is about to liberate them.